I am going to cover chapter 12. We are going to talk about sculpture. We have been talking about a lot of different art, primarily 2D design, anything that we can see from a flat surface. But now we're going to talk a little bit about three-dimensional works. So sculpture is a work in three dimensions. Think about things like height, breadth, and depth. Sculpture is something that is an experience within a space, and that there are two main types of sculpture. There are freestanding sculpture and relief sculpture. And if we take a look at this first example here, you can tell just from the aesthetic quality that it is contemporary work here. You're looking at two photographs, one of the front of the sculpture and one from the back of the sculpture. And you're probably looking at this and thinking, okay, what is this interesting contraption that we have here? We see a bunch of vertical and horizontal wooden beams piled upon a wheelbarrow, and that it is relatively tall. If we look in the back, we can see what appears to be a type of inlay. If we look closely to it, you can see there is a little bit of shape in there. Maybe you can see a pair of eyes, and maybe you can see a nose. It's actually a type of mask shape. And this work here is by Martin Bourrier, CFAO. Unpainted stack of wood on one side, a large curving shape based on an elongated African mask on the other, reference to laborers in Sierra Leone. And so Sierra Leone, a African country, what we are seeing here is this idea that in Sierra Leone, there are many woodworkers there, and that from what I can recall, there isn't exactly a standard, a good quality of life in terms of the woodworkers there. In fact, they do so much work, but at the same time, they have this type of behind the scene feeling where they're relatively unknown for the amount of work that they do. And so that's what we are seeing a depiction of here. And so some information on freestanding and relief sculptures. Freestanding or in the round is sculpture that was meant to be seen from all sides. So if there is a sculpture in a gallery space and that you can walk in front of it and you can walk beside it, you can walk behind it, that's what a freestanding sculpture is. So those are your typical sculptures. On the other side, you have a relief sculpture. A relief sculpture is something that projects from a background surface. So something about a relief sculpture, you're primarily looking at it from one particular side, usually the front side or the back side. And so when it comes to these relief sculptures, there are two different types. One of them is a low relief. You can also call them bas relief. For the sake of this class, they are more called low relief. And so what a low relief sculpture is, basically when there is a slight projection off of the surface. So think of a coin. If you have change, if you have quarters, if you have nickels or pennies, you'll notice that it's a disc shape, but you can see a shape that is carved into the material, and that the carving is very slight. It's just enough so that you can see a little bit of shape, and that's what low relief means. And so here is an example of a low relief sculpture here. So coin, this was made 1415, a coin of Apollo, 14-15 BCE before Christ era. So the carving is just enough so you could see a little bit of shadow, and that's an example of a low relief sculpture. And so let's take a look at this work here. Also an example of a low relief sculpture. If you are looking at this piece, you're probably wondering what country this might be from. I like to give a moment to allow students to guess what country do you think this might be from. If you are thinking Asia, then very nice. Something that you'll notice, you can see the elephant and that there are figures riding on the elephant. It looks like they are soldiers. And so these carvings are just enough so you can see actually a lot of detail with the figures, with the weapons, with the animals, the plant life. And notice how it looks like it has a bit of an atmospheric perspective effect in that there isn't exactly a lot of detail happening in the trees. And this work is called Army on the March, made in 1100 through 1150 AD, made from sandstone. It's actually from Angkor Wat, Cambodia. Okay, so this is an example of a low relief carving. And now let's take a look at this work here. This also is a type of relief because we are looking at a material that's been carved into and that we are looking at it from generally one side, usually the front. But what looks different in this sculpture is that the carving isn't exactly low. They're a little bit more exaggerated, a little bit deeper carvings, and the carving is almost as though you can see these shapes coming out of the material. And you're probably looking at this and marveling at the scene, this very chaotic scene, and you're wondering why are they wearing. I think that's something that I noticed right away is their clothing. It looks very contemporary, looks fairly recent. A lot of suits and ties, and we see men and women struggling with each other, but there are scenes of them helping one another, but overall very chaotic. Very chaotic. A lot of different diagonals being created by the arms and the pulling of the bodies and the falling down of the bodies, the leaning of the bodies. Overall, a scene of chaos and struggle. And so this is an example of a high relief sculpture. And so a high relief, very different from a low relief sculpture. When it comes to these high relief sculptures, more than half of the natural circumference projects from the surface. And this piece is called Corporate Wars, Wall of Influence by Robert Longo. You could probably say that the title gives away a lot of the message behind the work, the content. You can probably say that when it comes to business, when it comes to making money, especially between corporations, that it's basically war, that they're constantly fighting each other. Okay, so some of the methods and materials when it comes to sculpture modeling is this additive process of building up a material such as clay, wax, or plaster. When it comes to modeling, think of something like a naturalistic clay sculpture. Something about these clay sculptures, you can see the fingerprint impressions, and that usually gives away that this was done by this additive process. And so what we are talking about here, this additive process is we're building it up. We're building it from the ground up. We're piling this material on one another, then we're shaping it. That's what this additive process is all about. Basically adding to the material to create shape. And so sometimes a sculpture is made and it's not exactly sturdy. There are times when the sculptor would put an armature. An armature is this rigid inner support under soft materials. So an armature is very much like the skeleton of a work of art. Sometimes the clay is too soft because of the weight of the object, and maybe there are parts that extend from, say, the main mass of the sculpture, so it needs a little bit of support. That's what the armature is there for. So again, remember, additive process is when you are building it up. You're basically piling the material on top of each other. And so here's an example of modeling done in creating a sculpture. This ball player with three-part yoke and bird headdress, coming from the Maya classic period, 600 through 800. And so you can look at it and say that this is this modeling process made from clay. Something that you'll notice with a lot of work coming from that region, from the Mayan culture, from the Aztec culture, from the Incan culture, a lot of intricate clay and other stone modeling. And what is this ball playing thing all about? It's actually one of the most important rituals in Mesoamerica, in Southern America, where the players are basically reenacting a scene from their mythology. Maybe some of you have heard of the twin heroes, or this ongoing struggle between the sun and the moon. And so they have these ball playing events very frequently. It's actually a big part of their culture in that it helps determine who are landowners, who are the heads of states, and sometimes it leads to sacrifice. And so you can see that they're wearing this hip protection, because what the game is like is, from what I read, it's very much like racquetball, where they basically hit a ball and they keep it in play, and then if you mess up, then you lose. So that's what the ball playing was all about. Very big part of Mesoamerican culture and ritual. And so another large sculpture here. Judging on the material, it feels like a very contemporary piece. Looks like a type of paper mache. Maybe some of you have played around with that in the past. Very rough exterior here. You can see how large it actually is. If you look behind the sculpture on the wall, there's a little bit of an identification tag, and you can, in a way, imagine the scale because of that. And so we're looking at this piece and we're wondering things like, okay, it's not exactly a beautiful work of art. Maybe it can be to some people, but we are looking at the texture, and that we are looking at the figure itself or herself, figure of a sculpture of a woman. When it comes to portraying human form, we like to idealize them. We like to make them beautiful, but in this case, the artist portrays the sculpture in an unidealized manner, and we ask ourselves why. And so this piece is called Stubborn Woman, Orange Hands. Stubborn Woman, Orange Hands. And I believe I don't see the artist's name on this slide, but I think it might be on the captions. And so what this is an example of basically modeling, but you can see that it was put together in sections, and so you can probably guess there was an armature underneath. Visible scenes from armature. And so you're wondering, so what is this all about? I guess I should tell you so that you don't have to Google it later, right? And so Stubborn Woman, Orange Hands, from what I can remember, the artist wanted to portray this idea that in the workplace, say that you work in the office, in an office space, in a corporation environment, and that you'll notice that the important people will wear very formal clothing. They'll wear suits, they'll wear ties, and most of the time they are men. So when men are in power, when men are making money, they portray themselves in this way. And so when it comes to women in the workplace, they say, or at least the from what I remember, the this piece was about, the artist wanted to portray that women are actually more powerful when they are not wearing a uniform, and that there's a lot of womanization happening in the workplace, and that many women are successful because of other things, and not exactly the same reasons why men are, or the same reason why men can be successful. So, yes, very interesting way for a artist to express herself, a very feminist view, but yes, very interesting, very expressive. And so when it comes to sculpture, there's a lot of representational sculptures, but at the same time, there's a lot of abstract, and this is an example of that. Ken Price Vink, and this is actually an example of a non-representational sculpture. So artists can do many things. They don't have to portray people or natural objects. They can be very expressive and do abstract objects or non-representational objects like this. And so another method when it comes to creating sculpture is casting. Casting is this process that involves the substitution of one material for another. So if you, in one point in your life, ever, or maybe you probably know someone that injured themselves and that they had to wear a cast, that's probably the best way to remember this. You're basically, it's called casting, so there's probably a cast involved somehow. And casting is something that was developed in ancient China, Greece, and parts of Africa, used extensively in the West from the Renaissance times. So what casting is like basically is what artists or what sculptors initially do is they create the sculpture. They're going to end up using a material such as clay. They're gonna build it up. And so once they have the shape already there, they're actually gonna put a material around it. And that material is, if you can imagine, a type of binding material in that it's going to capture its overall form. And once that material is surrounding the original sculpture, they find a way to harden it. So they're going to, use a plaster or a glue all over or a cement all over the piece. And what they're going to end up doing is they're going to wait till it dries, then they're going to open it. And then when they open it, it's going to be hopefully a replication of the original sculpture. So that's what this casting method is all about. So, yes, there has to be an original work, it has to completely surround the original. And then there's going to be a removal of that mold. It may require disassembly, so they can actually break it down into sections, but they had to put it back together in sections also. And so what they end up doing with that cast is they put it back together without the original sculpture inside, so that there is this cavity. And then what they do is they put a casting liquid into that cavity. And then after some time, that liquid hardens and they can remove that cast. And there you go. You have a replication of the original sculpture. And so this video, I put them on the Canvas page for you guys to check out. So make sure you check those out. I think it always makes a little bit more sense when you see the actual process being used. So check it out. And so there's this type of casting process where the the original cast is lost, and they call that a lost wax process. So something about the lost wax process, the mold is used only once, and it is destroyed to remove the hardened cast. And so they use this method for certain materials, especially with wax. And it's called lost wax process because basically you can only use the mold once. After it makes one copy, then you have to destroy it in order for you to see the original sculpture. And so, yes, that is what the lost wax process is all about. And so if we take a look at this sculpture here, it looks like a very large plastic toy. And so this piece is called Father Figure by Charles Ray, made in 2007. Very large, 93 inches by 137 inches by 71 inches. So yes, very tall piece, about 8 feet high, about 11 feet in length. And so what the artist does here is he had an original toy, a very small regular plastic toy, and he basically made a cast of it, and he did it over and over and over again until it became this scale. And so it still maintains that quality. I'm pretty sure there's some modifications done along the way, but it still feels very much like the original. It looks very much like the original green toy it was based off of. Okay, and so we are looking at another work here, and you're probably thinking, whoa, what is this? Just the back of someone's pickup truck, right? And so this is a very interesting piece here because it's actually made from wood. Kaz Oshiro, tailgate OTA. Duplicates a Toyota pickup truck tailgate, a wooden armature viewed from behind. And so if I go back a little bit, look at the piece, and wow, that looks like metal to me. Looks like the real deal I'm looking at. It's pretty neat how the artist puts the text there, the Toyota text, but removes a lot of it. Something that you would expect when you see someone driving around in an old Toyota. You only see just remnants of the original text there. Very, very creative. Right? So with sculpture, many artists are doing different things, especially in the contemporary. And if we look at this piece here, and if we look at the material, it looks like it was made from a natural material. Maybe if you were thinking beeswax, this is actually something to appear just like it. Rachel Whiteread, Untitled Hive 1, 2007. And so the artist here uses this brown-orange resin, and she makes it look like a beehive, that same material used when bees are in their homes. And so with sculpture, artists are able to do so many different things that are basically like illusions. And so there is this artist here, this classical Greek artist named Zeuxis. Something about him is he was supposed to be one of the most talented sculptors to have ever lived, and that he can basically make anything look realistic. And so something about Zeuxis is that there are no known works to have survived. They're all destroyed. And so the story behind Zeuxis is that they say he was so good at sculpting, he would build, say, a sculpture, and that say that it is a sculpture of a boy, and that the sculpture was holding an apple, Okay, and so the what people say about Zeuxis is the store is the story behind him is that his sculpture of a boy holding the apple looks so real that a bird tried to eat the apple on the sculpture. And so Zeuxis, from what I remember, Zeuxis replied by saying that if his sculpture looked realistic, then the bird would be scared to eat the apple because he sees the boy there. And so, yes, Zeuxis is famed to be one of the greatest classical sculptors. Okay, so another method when it comes to creating sculpture is carving. So carving is a type of subtractive process of taking away unwanted material. So when it comes to modeling, that is more of a additive process. You're building something up, you're piling up materials on another. But when it comes to carving, it is a subtractive process, and you're doing the opposite. You're removing unwanted material. So a very different way to create sculpture. And so these are examples of a relief sculpture here, Michelangelo Awakening Slave. This is one of his unfinished pieces made from marble, 9 feet tall, 1530. And so marble is a very rich material in that it is one of the most challenging materials to work with. Basically, with marble, you can't make any mistakes because once if you chip too much, then there's no way you can, put that material back. So sculptors are, highly revered because of their skill to be perfect. And Michelangelo is probably the most popular sculptor. Something about Michelangelo is that he claims to have a divine power, that he can look at a material and that God gave him a vision that and that he was responsible for unlocking that object or unlocking that shape within the material. And so you'll see these relief sculptures. A lot of them turn to the Renaissance artists for inspiration. So Robert Longo, if we remember this work here, The Corporate Wars, Wall of Influence, it's basically almost a copy of this work by Michelangelo as well, Battle of Centaurs. Because that too is a very chaotic scene. In a way, you could say that this Corporate Wars is a homage to Michelangelo. Many identical elements. So when it comes to carving, you'll see marble being used a lot. Granite is one of the sought-after materials because it is less vulnerable to modern pollution. It lasts a lot longer. Another material for carving is sandstone and also limestone. Schist is a type of sand material used by Egyptians. So carvings can actually be used through many materials. In the East, we have jade. Jade is a material favored by the Chinese. And if you look at this work here, it's a very small coin in that even though it is a small piece, there is so much detail done in that small amount of space. You'll see some interesting texture on the coin. They're called bosses, these little raised circles. They're called bai when there is more than one boss. Okay, when it comes to carving, okay, so there is different materials. Wood is also a material sought after when it comes to carving. You could say that it's one of the easier materials to carve into. When it comes to carving wood, many sculptors like to use walnut or cypress. And so here is an example of a wood carving here, Elizabeth Catlett, mother and child. Very abstract, very expressive, very elegant, especially in terms of the way the overall shapes appear. It's just so elegant and so organic. So artists can do some pretty amazing things when it comes to carving and sculpture in general. And so I'm gonna go ahead and pause here, and I'll record part two in just a little bit. Hello and welcome back. This is part two of the chapter 12 PowerPoint on sculpture. We left off looking at this piece here, another work by Martine Pourrière, hominid made in 2007 through 2011. Very large abstract piece symbolizing a type of open-ended state. This pre-human primate related to a regular polygonal block on wooden rollers. Very interesting, very abstract. Let's talk a little bit more about different methods when it comes to sculpture. There are these assembled sculpture, something that became popular early in the 20th century. If you think about a sculpture that has many different objects and that they are put together, they are usually called this. They are usually called this assembled sculpture, or they are usually called an assemblage. So, easy way to remember, just assemble, putting together different things, different materials. And here is an example of an assemblage here. Julio Gonzalez, Maternity, made in 1934. Julio Gonzalez is the pioneer of using a welding torch in metal sculpture. He was a sculptor, an artist that assisted Picasso. And so, if we take a look at a sculpture, very abstract, we see very narrow lines. It is this type of open air, has this open air quality to it. Very abstract, a few circles here and there. Maybe some of you can look at the shape and think of the title, Maternity. Does it feel like anything maternal to you just from looking at these abstract shapes? Maybe you can imagine the right upper right hand corner of the photograph. That appears to be the head of this abstract woman with long hair, and that curved line underneath looks like her shoulders and arms outstretched and looks as though she's carrying a baby. At least that's what I'm interpreting from looking at this piece. And if you look at the rest of the form, there's a hint of her breasts in the center there, and then looks as though she's seated with her knees bent. Very abstract, but yes, when it comes to these types of works, they're basically different materials, different objects put together. In this case, they are welded together, and Gonzalez is the one that started this idea of using a torch in sculpture. Here's another of that same type, another assemblage, Deborah Butterfield, Conure, 2007. So what she does here, she creates these figures of horses from found materials in Montana and Hawaii. Basically, leftover parts from scrapped automobiles And what she's doing is she's finding these materials in junkyards and she's finding a way to give it new life. So breathing new life into objects that are no longer used. Another example of an assemblage here by Picasso, Bull's Head, 1943. Basically, the chair of a bicycle and the handlebars. Okay, something about Spain. You'll see a lot of the bull symbolism used in Spanish art. If you can recall the famous work by Picasso, Guernica, the bull representing fascist Spain. It's a very important symbol in their culture. And so, yes, assemblage again is an example is when the artist is basically putting together random objects, and in this case, using a welder, very similar to the Gonzalez piece. And here is another type of assemblage. And this one is made out of wood, and we are looking at this piece, and maybe it resembles a type of chair or a seat. You'll notice that it is actually made from different pieces. It looks like multiple chairs, maybe some other pieces of wood, maybe belts. So this piece here is by Marc-André Robinson, and the piece is called Throne for the Greatest Rapper of All Time, made in 2005. And so this is an assemblage made to look like a throne for the quote-unquote greatest rapper. I wonder who he was referring to here. I guess we had to look it up. I should have looked it up, but I'll leave that mystery to some of you who are interested. So again, another example of an object put together using different pieces, and that's what an assemblage is. And so now we're going to talk a little bit about kinetic sculpture. Kinetic sculpture is sculpture that moves. Alexander Calder is the pioneer of this type of work. Focuses on shape, space, and movement. Sometimes they are called mobiles because the parts move in response to small air currents. So any type of sculpture that has movement is a kinetic sculpture. So kinetic, think energy, think movement. And if we can think of things like the Memorial of Mount Iwo Jima, the soldiers that they are bound together and that they are lifting up a American flag. The flag is responding to the wind, and so that is an example of a kinetic sculpture. So yes, any kind of sculpture that has movement is called kinetic sculpture. We often call them mobiles. And so this work here, Jesus Rafael Soto, Hurtado writing. We're looking at this inner space within a gallery, and that there are these wires hanging down. Wires, nylon cords, and when people open a door and they close it, you can see very subtle movement coming from these materials. So now we're going to talk a little bit about mixed media. Mixed media is when there is a variety of media in a single work. Often represents a cultural or symbolic meaning. So whenever it comes to mixed media, there's usually a reason why they chose that particular material. And so here we're looking at a very large installation. Imagine that you're walking into a museum and you see these cars hanging in the middle of the ceiling. You have these materials coming out from the vehicles and there's lights on them. In a way, the lights are replicating explosions. And so, what are we thinking? What is the artist trying to say in this piece? Looks like something right out of an action movie. Very interesting piece by Sai Guo Chiang. This piece is called Inopportune Stage One. Nine automobiles perforated with light tubes, references to both contemporary and action movies and car bombings by terrorists. And so let me go back to the larger image here. And if we think about those two ideas just mentioned, Sai Guo Chiang is he's probably the most popular contemporary artist from China right now. And what he does is he creates these large installation sculptures. He usually has two themes in one. One theme is referring to something that is more traditional, something more of a classical approach, while the other is more contemporary or whatever is happening right now. And so, if you were to look at this, it would right away resemble something that you would see in television. If you were to watch an action movie, maybe you watched Mission Impossible or you watched, I don't know, Die Hard, and you can remember scenes where, or Fast and the Furious, where you're remembering scenes where there's all this action happening, the car, bumps into something and flies in the air, and it's so exciting because it's an action film, and that these companies are putting in millions of dollars to create a scene where we can feel excitement from, and but at the same time, it can also remind us of a terrorist bombing, and so. There are terrorist bombings around the world where the terrorists would actually use cars, and that when they blow up, they would fly into the air. And so Sai Guo Chiang tries to put two different ideas into one, in that usually there's a contrast. One side of it is very, very playful, very exciting. On the other hand, it's very serious and it's very scary to think about that. So one of the reasons why that is one of the reasons why he is so popular. He makes such strong work, very strong content-driven work. And so here's another example of a work here, also mixed media. Very awkward looking form. Grim Boy by Lara Schnitger, 2005. Some things about this piece has fabric over wooden armatures. There's a hollow interior, elements of fashion design. Something about this is resembling dressmaking. Dressmaking is a type of feminist art. And so, what is this Grim Boy all about? What is this awkward looking sculpture about? Basically, this idea that, okay, grim, what do we think about? We think of something that might be scary, something that might be dark. And so, the artist, if I can try, I'm trying to remember, I'm remembering these things as we go on. I didn't study really, but let's see if I can remember. Grim Boy was really about this idea that when teenagers get into a certain age, they become a little bit awkward in terms of the way they appear. Maybe their body feels they get really tall really fast, but then, their head is still small and they just get over, they get tall. Maybe their feet, it's not really matching the rest of their body, but at the same time, there's a very serious side to this, and that it mentions here that there's this tense, lurking, and bird-like stare, and that there's this idea that some teenager boys can be really unpredictable, and that you're not really sure if how they're going to act, how they're going to respond. If I can remember the artist and some of her ideas behind it was that sometimes people are uncomfortable around teenager boys because, you know, they're not really respectful. So you look at this grim boy sculpture and you see that the head is it seems as though it's poking forward and it's aggressively shifting its body towards somebody, towards something. And so the artist is conveying these types of feelings that she gets from being around teenager boys. Another example of mixed media here, The Seller and the Sold. And so some interesting things about this piece, even though it is made from drywall, glass, wax, foam, pigment, it looks like a very archaic material. Looks like it was made from rock. And what is inside are these figures, and it looks as though it is mummified. So the artist is trying to make this idea of mummified king. The title reminds the viewer of The Business World, The Seller and the Sold by Matthew Monaghan, 2006. And so, more info on sculptures. We have these installations. Installations are when artists create this transformation of a space by bringing in items of symbolic significance. Constructed sculpture of a space. So, whenever an artist comes into, say, a particular space, most likely a gallery space, and changes it up so that when people enter that space, that there is some symbology peeking through. It's basically making people feel different. That's what an installation is. And so, if we look at this piece here, you're looking at glass or cups that are sticking on a wall. So maybe if you are young, and I don't know if this pertains to our youth, maybe it does more mine than our average students who are very young. Maybe if you are young enough to remember, people used to use cups and they would put them against the wall and they would try to listen to what they can hear people talking on the other side just from putting that cup on the wall. They would put their ear against the cup and they can, in a way, eavesdrop at whatever is going on in another room. And so that's what these cups represent, that nostalgic idea of how we used to eavesdrop on our siblings, on our parents. So the artist basically putting these mundane objects on the wall. When we walk in, we feel very different and we are fascinated by this idea that, oh yeah, I remember that. And that, and that the artist again provokes us to think a different way when we enter that space. That's what installations are all about. Amelia Pica, eavesdropping. 2011, so not too long ago. And so there are other types of sculptures and installations, and one of them is called a site-specific. So site-specific, think of the actual location. Works intended for only for a particular location. So a lot of these are these types of earthworks or land art. Usually they are created outdoors. So installations are usually in a space, in a gallery space of some sort. Site-specific is more outside, it's more outdoors, and so we call these earthworks as well. And so here's an example of a land art or a location art. And so we have this very abstract wall in the middle of these buildings. Tilted Ark by Richard Serra. There's a video link. Make sure you check that out on our Canvas module. This was made in 1981. And so basically, the artist transforming that space again, These earthworks are usually outside. This doesn't exactly feel like an earthwork because it's very, metallic, and it's in this bustling part of town. Some interesting things about this work: it eventually attracted many homeless people, and that there was a lot of graffiti, and so I'm not sure if that was intended to happen with the work, but that's what ended up happening. And so some different things can happen when art is, out in the open, out for the public like this, in a way the artist intended for, people to feel different. And so it definitely made its mark there. So check out that video. And so here is an example of another type of site-specific work. So you can imagine going into a gallery and you see this, what appears to be a sun shape in the middle of the ceiling there, and that there is this mystifying effect. It feels like fog. And this work is by Olafur Eliasson, The Weather Project, from the Unilever series, made in 2003. And so this is a site-specific piece made indoors. There's a sun in the center, and if you can imagine for a moment, in that space, there's a lot of fog, and that the fog was actually made from dry ice. So it's as though it was a foggy day, but the artist replicated that feeling within the interior space of this gallery, and that he had this idea where people would come into the gallery and that they would walk in this very foggy environment, and they wouldn't know who was in front of them, who were the people in that space. And so in a way he felt like it was bringing people together, because we're so used to feeling comfortable with the amount of clarity that we depend on an everyday basis. But when you walk in a place where it's very foggy and you can't really tell who's in front of you, then it makes you feel differently. It's as though you're reimagining these people, you're revitalizing your senses in a way. So yes, overall, just makes people feel very different, and that's what site-specific works are made to do.